Chapter 5. It was after midnight. Though Christmas had been in bed for 2 hours, he wasn't yet asleep. He heard Brown before he saw him. He heard Brown approach the door and then blunder into it, in silhouette, propping himself erect in the door. Brown was breathing heavily. Standing there between his propped arms, Brown began to sing in a saccharine and nasal tenor. The very long-drawn pitch of his voice seemed to smell of whiskey.
"Shut it," Christmas said.
He didn't move and his voice wasn't raised. Yet Brown ceased at once. He stood for a moment longer in the door, propping himself upright. Then he let go of the door and Christmas heard him stumble into the room. A moment later, he blundered into something. There was an interval filled with hard, labored breathing. Then Brown fell to the floor with a tremendous clatter, striking the cot on which Christmas lay and filling the room with loud and idiot laughter. Christmas rose from his cot. Invisible beneath him, Brown lay on the floor, laughing, making no effort to rise.
"Shut it," Christmas said.
Brown still laughed. Christmas stepped across Brown and put his hand out toward where a wooden box that served for table sat, on which the lantern and matches were kept. But he couldn't find the box, and then he remembered the sound of the breaking lantern when Brown fell. He stooped astride Brown and found his collar and hauled him out from beneath the cot and raised Brown's head and began to strike him with his flat hand. Short, vicious, and hard, until Brown ceased laughing. Brown was limp. Christmas held his head up, cursing him in a voice level as whispering. He dragged Brown over to the other cot and flung him onto it face up. Brown began to laugh again. Christmas put his hand flat upon Brown's mouth and nose, shutting his jaw with his left hand, while with the right he struck Brown again, with those hard, slow, measured blows, as if he were meeting them out by count. Brown had stopped laughing. He struggled. Beneath Christmas's hand, he began to make a choked, gurgling noise, struggling. Christmas held him until he ceased and became still. Then Christmas slacked his hand a little.
"Will you be quiet now?" he said. "Will you?"
Brown struggled again.
"Take your black hand off me, you damn nigger-blooded."
The hand shut down again. Again, Christmas struck him with the other hand upon the face. Brown ceased and lay still again. Christmas slacked his hand. After a moment, Brown spoke, in a tone cunning, not loud.
"You're a nigger, see? You said so yourself. You told me. But I'm white. I'm a what?"
The hand shut down. Again Brown struggled, making choked, whimpering sound beneath the hand, drooling upon the fingers. When he stopped struggling, the hand slacked. Then he lay still, breathing hard.
"Will you now?"
Christmas said.
"Yes," Brown said. He breathed noisily. "Let me breathe. I'll be quiet. Let me breathe."
Christmas slacked his hand, but he didn't remove it. Beneath it, Brown breathed easier. His breath came and went easier with less noise. But Christmas didn't remove the hand. He stood in the darkness above the prone body, with Brown's breath alternately hot and cold on his fingers, thinking quietly,
"Something is going to happen to me. I am going to do something."
Without removing his left hand from Brown's face, he could reach with his right across to his cot, to his pillow, beneath which lay his razor with its 5-inch blade. But he didn't do it. perhaps thinking it already gone far enough and dark enough to tell him, this isn't the right one. Anyway, he didn't reach for the razor. After a time, he removed his hand from Brown's face, but he didn't go away. He still stood above the cot, his own breathing so quiet, so calm as to make no sound even to himself. Invisible, too, Brown breathed quieter now, and after a while, Christmas returned and sat upon his cot and fumbled a cigarette and a match from his trousers hanging on the wall. In the flare of the match, Brown was visible. Before taking the light, Christmas lifted the match and looked at Brown. Brown lay on his back, sprawled, one arm dangling to the floor. His mouth was open. While Christmas watched, he began to snore. Christmas lit the cigarette and snapped the match toward the open door, watching the flame vanish in midair. Then he was listening for the light, trivial sound which the dead match would make when it struck the floor. And then it seemed to him that he heard it. Then it seemed to him, sitting on the cot in the dark room, that he was hearing a myriad sounds of no greater volume. Voices, murmurs, whispers of trees, darkness, earth, people, his own voice, other voices evocative of names and times and places, which he'd been conscious of all his life without knowing it, which were his life. Thinking, God perhaps, and me not knowing that too. He could see it like a printed sentence, full-born and already dead. God loves me too. Like the faded and weathered letters on a last year's billboard. God loves me too. He smoked the cigarette down without once touching it with his hand. He snapped it too toward the door. Unlike the match, it didn't vanish in mid-flight. He watched it twinkle end over end through the door. He lay back on the cot, his hands behind his head as a man lies who doesn't expect to sleep, thinking, I've been in bed now since 10 o'clock, and I have not gone to sleep. I don't know what time it is, but it is later than midnight, and I haven't yet been asleep. It's because she started praying over me, he said. He spoke aloud, his voice sudden and loud in the dark room above Brown's drunken snoring. That's it. Because she started praying over me. He rose from the cot. His bare feet made no sound. He stood in the darkness in his underclothes. On the other cot, Brown snored. For a moment, Christmas stood, his head turned toward the sound. Then he went on toward the door. In his underclothes and barefoot, he left the cabin. It was a little lighter outdoors. Overhead, the slow constellations wheeled, the stars of which he'd been aware for 30 years, and not one of which had any name to him or meant anything at all by shape or brightness or position. Ahead, rising from out a close mass of trees, he could see one chimney and one gable of the house. The house itself was invisible and dark. No light shone and no sound came from it when he approached and stood beneath the window of the room where she slept, thinking, if she is asleep too, if she is asleep, the doors were never locked, and it used to be that at whatever hour between dark and dawn that the desire took him, he would enter the house and go to her bedroom and take his sure way through the darkness to her bed. Sometimes she would be awake and waiting, and she would speak his name. At others, he would waken her with his hard, brutal hand, and sometimes take her as hard and as brutally before she was good awake. That was 2 years ago. 2 years behind them now. Thinking, perhaps that is where outrage lies. Perhaps I believe that I've been tricked, fooled, that she lied to me about our age, about what happens to women at a certain age. He said aloud, solitary, in the darkness beneath the dark window, "She ought not to started praying over me. She would have been all right if she hadn't started praying over me. Wasn't her fault that she got too old to be any good anymore. But she ought to have had better sense than to pray over me." He began to curse her. He stood beneath the dark window, cursing her with slow and calculated obscenity. He wasn't looking at the window. In the less than half light, he appeared to be watching his body, seeming to watch it turning slow and lascivious in a whispering of gutter filth, like a drowned corpse in a thick, still black pool of more than water. He touched himself with his flat hands, hard, drawing his hands hard up his abdomen and chest inside his undergarment. It was held together by a single button at the top. Once he'd owned garments with intact buttons. A woman had sewed them on. That was for a time, during a time. Then the time passed. After that, he would purloin his own garments from the family wash before she could get to them and replace the missing buttons. When she foiled him, he set himself deliberately to learn and remember which buttons were missing and had been restored. With his pocket knife and with the cold and bloodless deliberation of a surgeon, he would cut off the buttons which she had just replaced. His right hand slid fast and smooth as the knife blade had ever done, up the opening in the garment. Edgewise, it struck the remaining button, a light, swift blow. The dark air breathed upon him, breathed smoothly as the garment slipped down his legs. The cool mouth of darkness, the soft, cool tongue. Moving again, he could feel the dark air like water. He could feel the dew under his feet as he'd never felt dew before. He passed through the broken gate and stopped beside the road. The August weeds were thigh tall. Upon the leaves and stalks, dust of a month of passing wagons lay. The road ran before him. It was a little paler than the darkness of trees and earth. In one direction town lay, in the other the road rose to a hill. After a time a light began to grow beyond the hill, defining it. Then he could hear the car. He didn't move. He stood with his hands on his hips, naked, thigh deep in the dusty weeds, while the car came over the hill and approached, the lights full upon him. He watched his body grow white out of the darkness like a Kodak print emerging from the liquid. He looked straight into the headlights as it shot past. A woman's shrill voice flew back shrieking, "White bastards," he shouted. "That's not the first of your bitches that ever saw." But the car was gone. There was no one to hear, to listen. It was gone, sucking its dust and its light with it and behind it, sucking with it the white woman's fading cry. He was cold now. It was as though he'd merely come there to be present at a finality, and the finality had now occurred, and he was free again. He returned to the house. Beneath the dark window, he paused and hunted and found his undergarment and put it on. There was no remaining button at all now, and he had to hold it together as he returned to the cabin. Already he could hear Brown snoring. He stood for a while at the door, motionless and silent, listening to the long, harsh, uneven suspirations, ending each in a choked gurgle. "I must have hurt his nose more than I knew," he thought. "Damn son of a bitch." He entered and went to his cot, preparing to lie down. He was in the act of reclining when he stopped, halted, half reclining. Perhaps the thought of himself lying there until daylight, with the drunken man snoring in the darkness and the intervals filled with the myriad voices, was more than he could bear. Because he sat up and fumbled quietly beneath his cot and found his shoes and slipped them on and took from the cot the single half-cotton blanket which composed his bedding and left the cabin. About 300 yards away, the stable stood. It was falling down and there hadn't been a horse in it in 30 years. Yet it was toward the stable that he went. He was walking quite fast. He was thinking now, aloud now, "Why in hell do I want to smell horses?" Then he said, fumbling, "It's because they aren't women. Even a male horse is a kind of man." He slept less than 2 hours. When he waked, dawn was just beginning. Lying in the single blanket upon the loosely planked floor of the sagging and gloomy cavern, acrid with the thin dust of departed hay, and faintly ammoniac with that breathless desertion of old stables, he could see through the shutterless window in the eastern wall the primrose sky and the high, pale morning star of full summer. He felt quite rested, as if he'd slept an unbroken 8 hours. It was the unexpected sleep, since he hadn't expected to sleep at all. With his feet again in the unlaced shoes and the folded blanket beneath his arm, he descended the perpendicular ladder, feeling for the rotting and invisible rungs with his feet, lowering himself from rung to rung in one-handed swoops. He emerged into the gray and yellow of dawn, the clean chill, breathing it deep. The cabin now stood sharp against the increasing east, and the clump of trees also within which the house was hidden, save for the single chimney. The dew was heavy in the tall grass. His shoes were wet at once. The leather was cold to his feet. Against his bare legs, the wet grass blades were like strokes of limber icicles. Brown had stopped snoring. When Christmas entered, he could see Brown by the light from the eastern window. He breathed quietly now. "Sober now," Christmas thought. "Sober and don't know it. Poor bastard." He looked at Brown. "Poor bastard, he'll be mad when he wakes up and finds out that he's sober again. Take him maybe a whole hour to get back drunk again." He put down the blanket and dressed, in the serge trousers, the white shirt a little soiled now, the bow tie. He was smoking. Nailed to the wall was a shard of mirror. In the fragment he watched his dim face as he knotted the tie. The stiff hat hung on a nail. He didn't take it down. He took instead a cloth cap from another nail, and from the floor beneath his cot a magazine of that type whose covers bear either pictures of young women in underclothes or pictures of men in the act of shooting one another with pistols. From beneath the pillow on his cot, he took his razor and a brush and a stick of shaving soap and put them into his pocket. When he left the cabin, it was quite light. The birds were in full chorus. This time he turned his back on the house. He went on past the stable and entered the pasture beyond it. His shoes and his trouser legs were soon sopping with gray dew. He paused and rolled his trousers gingerly to his knees and went on. At the end of the pasture, woods began. The dew wasn't so heavy here, and he rolled his trousers down again. After a while, he came to a small valley in which a spring rose. He put down the magazine and gathered twigs and dried brush and made a fire and sat, his back against a tree and his feet to the blaze. Presently, his wet shoes began to steam. He could feel the heat moving up his legs, and then all of a sudden he opened his eyes and saw the high sun, that the fire had burned completely out, and he knew that he'd been asleep. "Damned if I haven't," he thought. "Damned if I haven't slept again." He'd slept more than 2 hours this time, because the sun was shining down upon the spring itself, glinting and glancing upon the ceaseless water. He rose, stretching his cramped and stiffened back, waking his tingling muscles. From his pocket he took the razor, the brush, the soap. Kneeling beside the spring, he shaved, using the water's surface for glass, stropping the long, bright razor on his shoe. He concealed the shaving things and the magazine in a clump of bushes and put on the tie again. When he left the spring, he bore now well away from the house. When he reached the road, he was a half mile beyond the house. A short distance further on stood a small store with a gasoline pump before it. He entered the store, and a woman sold him crackers and a tin of potted meat. He returned to the spring, the dead fire. He ate his breakfast with his back against the tree, reading the magazine while he ate. He'd previously read but one story. He began now upon the second one, reading the magazine straight through as though it were a novel. Now and then he would look up from the page, chewing, into the sunshot leaves which arched the ditch. "Maybe I've already done it," he thought. "Maybe it's no longer now waiting to be done." It seemed to him that he could see the yellow day opening peacefully on before him like a corridor, an arras, into a still chiaroscuro without urgency. It seemed to him that as he sat there, the yellow day contemplated him drowsily like a prone and somnolent yellow cat. Then he read again. He turned the pages in steady progression, though now and then he would seem to linger upon one page, one line, perhaps one word. He wouldn't look up then. He wouldn't move, apparently arrested and held immobile by a single word, which had perhaps not yet impacted. His whole being, suspended by the single trivial combination of letters in quiet and sunny space, so that hanging motionless and without physical weight, he seemed to watch the slow flowing of time beneath him, thinking, "All I wanted was peace." Thinking, "She ought not to started praying over me." When he reached the last story, he stopped reading and counted the remaining pages. Then he looked at the sun and read again. He read now like a man walking along a street might count the cracks in the pavement to the last and final page, the last and final word. Then he rose and struck a match to the magazine and prodded it patiently until it was consumed. With the shaving things in his pocket, he went on down the ditch. After a while it broadened, a smooth, sand-blanched floor between steep, shelving walls, choked, flank, and crest, with briar and brush. Over it, trees still arched, and in a small cove in one flank, A mass of dead brush lay, filling the cove. He began to drag the brush to one side, clearing the cove and exposing a short-handled shovel. With the shovel, he began to dig in the sand, which the brush had concealed, exhuming one by one 6 metal tins with screw tops. He didn't unscrew the caps. He laid the tins on their sides, and with the sharp edge of the shovel, he pierced them. The sand beneath them darkening as the whiskey spurted and poured. The sunny solitude, the air, becoming redolent with alcohol. He emptied them thoroughly, unhurried, his face completely cold, mask-like almost. When they were all empty, he tumbled them back into the hole and buried them roughly and dragged the brush back and hid the shovel again. The brush hid the stain, but it couldn't hide the scent, the smell. He looked at the sun again. It was now afternoon. At 7 o'clock that evening, he was in town, in a restaurant on a side street, eating his supper. Sitting on a backless stool at a friction-smooth wooden counter, eating. At 9 o'clock, he was standing outside the barbershop, looking through the window at the man whom he'd taken for a partner. He stood quite still, with his hands in his trousers and cigarette smoke drifting across his still face, and the cloth cap worn, like the stiff hat, at that angle at once swaggering and baleful. So cold, so baleful he stood there, that Brown, inside the shop, among the lights, the air heavy with lotion and hot soap, gesticulant, thick-voiced, in the soiled red-barred trousers and the soiled colored shirt, looked up in mid-voice, and with his drunken eyes looked into the eyes of the man beyond the glass. So still and baleful that a Negro youth, shuffling up the street, whistling, saw Christmas's profile and ceased whistling and edged away and slid past behind him, turning, looking back over his shoulder. But Christmas was moving himself now, as if he'd just paused there for Brown to look at him. He went on, not fast, away from the square. The street, a quiet one at all times, was deserted at this hour. It led down through the Negro section, Freedman Town, to the station. At 7 o'clock he would have passed people, white and black, going toward the square and the picture show. At 9:30 they would have been going back home. But the picture show hadn't turned out yet, and he now had the street to himself. He went on, passing still between the homes of white people, from street lamp to street lamp, the heavy shadows of oak and maple leaves sliding like scraps of black velvet across his white shirt. Nothing can look quite as lonely as a big man going along an empty street. Yet though he wasn't large, not tall, he contrived somehow to look more lonely than a lone telephone pole in the middle of a desert. In the wide, empty, shadow-brooded street, he looked like a phantom, a spirit strayed out of its own world and lost. Then he found himself. Without his being aware, the street had begun to slope, and before he knew it, he was in Freedman Town, surrounded by the summer smell and the summer voices of invisible Negroes. They seemed to enclose him like bodiless voices murmuring, talking, laughing in a language not his. As from the bottom of a thick black pit, he saw himself enclosed by cabin shapes, vague, kerosene-lit, so that the street lamps themselves seemed to be further spaced, as if the black life, the black breathing, had compounded the substance of breath so that not only voices, but moving bodies and light itself must become fluid and accrete slowly from particle to particle of and with the now ponderable night, inseparable and one. He was standing still now, breathing quite hard, glaring this way and that. About him the cabins were shaped blackly out of blackness by the faint, sultry glow of kerosene lamps. On all sides, even within him, the bodiless, fecund mellow voices of Negro women murmured. It was as though he and all other man-shaped life about him had been returned to the lightless, hot, wet, primogenitive female. He began to run, glaring, his teeth glaring, his in-breath cold on his dry teeth and lips, toward the next street lamp. Beneath it, a narrow and rutted lane turned and mounted to the parallel street out of the black hollow. He turned into it, running, and plunged up the sharp ascent, his heart hammering, and into the higher street. He stopped here, panting, glaring, his heart thudding, as if it couldn't or wouldn't yet believe that the air now was the cold, hard air of white people. Then he became cool. The Negro smell, the Negro voices were behind and below him now. To his left lay the square, the clustered lights, low, bright birds in still-winged and tremulous suspension. To the right, the street lamps marched on, spaced, intermittent with bitten and unstirring branches. He went on, slowly again, his back toward the square, passing again between the houses of white people. There were people on these porches, too, and in chairs upon the lawns, but he could walk quiet here. Now and then he could see them, heads in silhouette, a white blurred garment in shape on a lighted veranda. Four people sat about a card table, the white faces intent and sharp in the low light, the bare arms of the women glaring smooth and white above the trivial cards. "That's all I wanted," he thought. "That don't seem like a whole lot to ask." This street, in turn, began to slope, but it sloped safely. His steady white shirt and pacing dark legs died among long shadows bulging square and huge against the August stars. A cotton warehouse, a horizontal and cylindrical tank like the torso of a beheaded mastodon, a line of freight cars. He crossed the tracks, the rails coming momentarily into twin green glints from a switch lamp, glinting away again. Beyond the tracks, woods began, but he found the path unerringly. It mounted among the trees, the lights of the town now beginning to come into view again across the valley where the railroad ran. But he didn't look back until he reached the crest of the hill. Then he could see the town, the glare, the individual lights where streets radiated from the square. He could see the street down which he'd come, and the other street, the one which had almost betrayed him, and further away and at right angles the far bright rampart of the town itself, and in the angle between the black pit from which he'd fled with drumming heart and glaring lips. No light came from it. From here no breath, no odor. It just lay there, black, impenetrable, in its garland of August tremulous lights. It might have been the original quarry, abyss itself. His way was sure, despite the trees, the darkness. He never once lost the path which he couldn't even see. The woods continued for a mile. He emerged into a road with dust under his feet. He could see now the vague spreading world, the horizon. Here and there faint windows glowed, but most of the cabins were dark. Nevertheless, his blood began again, talking and talking. He walked fast, in time to it. He seemed to be aware that the group were Negroes before he could have seen or heard them at all, before they even came in sight vaguely against the defunctive dust. There were five or six of them, in a straggling body yet vaguely paired. Again there reached him above the noise of his own blood, the rich murmur of women voices. He was walking directly toward them, walking fast. They'd seen him, and they gave to one side of the road, the voices ceasing. He too changed direction, crossing toward them as if he intended to walk them down. In a single movement, and as though at a spoken command, the women faded back and were going around him, giving him a wide berth. One of the men followed them as if he were driving them before him, looking over his shoulder as he passed. The other two men had halted in the road, facing Christmas. Christmas had stopped also. Neither seemed to be moving, yet they approached, looming, like two shadows drifting up. He could smell Negro. He could smell cheap cloth and sweat. The head of the Negro, higher than his own, seemed to stoop out of the sky, against the sky. "It's a white man," he said without turning his head, quietly. "What you want, white folks? You looking for somebody?" The voice was not threatful, neither was it servile. "Come on away from there, Jupe," the one who'd followed the women said. "Who you looking for, Cap'n?" the Negro said. "Jupe," one of the women said, her voice a little high. "You come on now." For a moment longer, the two heads, the light and the dark, seemed to hang suspended in the darkness, breathing upon one another. Then the Negro's head seemed to float away. A cool wind blew from somewhere. Christmas, turning slowly, watching them dissolve and fade again into the pale road, found that he had the razor in his hand. It wasn't open. It wasn't from fear. "Bitches," he said quite loud. "Sons of bitches." The wind blew dark and cool. The dust, even through his shoes, was cool. "What the hell is the matter with me?" he thought. He put the razor back into his pocket and stopped and lit a cigarette. He had to moisten his lips several times to hold the cigarette. In the light of the match, he could watch his own hands shake. "All this trouble," he thought. "All this damn trouble," he said aloud, walking again. He looked up at the stars, the sky. "Must be near 10 now," he thought. Then, almost with the thought, he heard the clock on the courthouse 2 miles away. Slow, measured, clear, the 10 strokes came. He counted them, stopped again in the lonely and empty road. 10 o'clock, he thought. "I heard 10 strike last night, too, and 11, and 12. But I didn't hear 1. Maybe the wind had changed." When he heard 11 strike tonight, he was sitting with his back against a tree inside the broken gate, while behind him again the house was dark and hidden in its shaggy grove. He wasn't thinking, "Maybe she isn't asleep either tonight." He wasn't thinking at all now. Thinking hadn't begun now. The voices hadn't begun now either. He just sat there, not moving, till after a while he heard the clock 2 miles away strike 12. Then he rose and moved toward the house. He didn't go fast. He didn't think even then, "Something's going to happen. Something is going to happen to me."